Civil Justice Committee meeting will come to order. Representative Hillstrom moves the minutes of March 8th and March 10th. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Hillstrom moves House File 910. Representative Hortman, go ahead with a very brief explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 910 updates the notary public statute, and with me from the Secretary of State's office is Bert Black, and he will explain the bill.
Very briefly.
30 seconds.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Bert Black, legal advisor for the Office of the Secretary of State. Notary laws are found in Chapters 357, 358, and 359 of Minnesota statutes, but they haven't been looked at for quite some time. And so 2 years ago, the Secretary of State's office put together a study group including county recorders, the Commerce Department, Governor's Office, the various financial associations, the Bar Association, members of the legislature, and the courts, and a number of others. And to look at the notary laws of the state, and this is a parallel to the effort on the part of NCUSL, which is revising the uniform law on of notarial acts. That law, ULANA, is coming to you probably later. This is not ULANA. This is a set of changes to our current law. There are a number of changes. Let me just hit the highlights.
Mr. Black, you're over your 30 seconds, but
okay.
Representative Hortman, there's a couple of amendments.
Sure.
Do you need these or not?
I do. Maybe
Representative Hillstrom will move A6 first to get it partly in the shape the author wants, correct?
Correct.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Representative Hillstrom now moves A7 to finalize it in the shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Mr. Chair, there's no fees in the bill. I just want to be clear. There was a move a few years ago to increase the fee from $1 to $5, and we took that out at Representative Pawlowski's request. And so the only thing that we're doing here is we're changing the way a certain fee is paid instead of breaking it into two pieces and people paying one part to the county and one part to the state, and then the county remits part to the state. So you'll see reference to fees, but it's about consolidation. There is one fee provision, but it's not increasing a fee that's in statute. It's putting one where there wasn't one.
Okay. Is there any opposition to this bill? Any opposition? Okay. Any members? Okay. Representative Hillstrom renews her motion, and this goes to the House floor, is it?
Yes, sir.
Renews her motion to pass House File 910 as amended and send it to General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Hillstrom moves House File 3318. Representative Hortman, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only thing you need to know about this is it's the Uniform Unsworn Foreign Declarations Act. So it's the first time, to my knowledge, we'll be passing a bill known as the UFTA provision. So if you're in favor of anything Norwegian, I think you should vote for the bill because of its acronym. Mr. Chair, we do have an A1 amendment that's a technical change.
Yes, sir.
Representative Hillstrom moves the A1 amendment to get in the shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Bob Tennyson, on behalf of the Bar Association, is here with me.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm Robert Tennyson. I'm here on behalf of the Uniform Law Conference. This problem of retaining a notary when someone's in a foreign country became more pronounced after 9/11. The American Bar Association asked the Uniform Law Conference to draft the Uniform Act. We did. It permits people to make a statement, an unsworn statement under penalty of perjury, and allows that to be used in the United States. A person has to be located outside the jurisdiction of the United States to make the statement, and this parallels what's already done in the federal law.
Okay, is there any opposition to this bill? A question by Representative Jackson.
I'm wondering, we spoke, Mr. Tennyson, yesterday. I don't see an exception for a power of attorney. Where would that fit?
Mr. Tennyson.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Representative Cooley Jackson, The exceptions are subdivision 3. They're the deposition oath of office, oath required to be given a specific official other than notary, declaration of covenants, real estate, so on, and an oath under another section. But I don't know, you know, maybe yesterday I was confused about that. I don't receive a specific provision on that.
President Jackson.
Off the top of my head, maybe I should just check what oath under section 524-2504, do you know off the top of your head?
That's a probate section.
That's a probate.
Okay, so that might be oath of acceptance of appointment or something?
I'll check it with talk to you later.
Okay.
And the motion should be to send the bill to the Public Safety and Policy Committee as amended.
Which Representative Jackson is on. Any other discussion? Okay, then Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to. Did we adopt the amendment?
Yeah.
Okay. To pass House File 3318 as amended and send it to the Public Safety Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you. Representative Jackson moves her own bill, 2970. This is always the most exciting bill. go ahead, Representative Jackson, in a very shortened form. We don't need to know all 85 pages or whatever.
You mean you don't want me to read it?
No, preferably only half at the most.
I have an amendment.
An amendment. Representative Jackson moves the A-10-2193 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead.
All right, well, I'm going to turn this over to our reviser, Michelle Timmons, as she's the mastermind and the organization behind this.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Michelle Timmons, the reviser of statutes, and this is the annual reviser's bill that corrects errors that were found in previous sessions of the legislature. And as Chair Mullery mentioned, this is the most exciting bill you'll see this year, and it mostly corrects cross-reference errors, grammatical corrections, and removes obsolete language. So if there are any questions.
I think we'll do it that way. Is there anybody in the audience that has anything to say about the reviser's bill? Great passion. Okay, anybody on the committee? Then Representative Kulik Jackson renews her motion to pass House File 2970 as amended to the General Register. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Committee.
Representative Hillstrom moves House File 2699.
Mr. Chair, this is going to go to Commerce. Mr. Chair, we do have an amendment. It's the DE1, and then we do need to amend the DE1, just deleting a section.
That's my understanding, is you're taking out section 1 of the DE1. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom moves the DE1 amendment without section 1 to get in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Hillstrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was brought to me by Legal Aid, and so I just am going to turn it over to them.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Good morning. This bill is addressing two problems that have emerged, yet another fallout from the foreclosure crisis. The first issue is the relatively new but increasing phenomenon where bid prices at auctions are coming in lower than what the amount owed on the mortgage, and that it's important that homeowners are informed as to what the price is that they need to pay to redeem their property to potentially save their home. So the first part of this bill provides some notice on that score, And the second issue is a new equity stripping scam that's emerged where folks are going to the bids, observing the bids, and then when they see that there's a very low bid and a potentially high profit to be made, they seek to acquire title from the homeowner before the homeowner would know what the price to redeem is. And we've had situations where homeowners have turned over their homes for $200 for a quitclaim deed, only to learn later that they could have redeemed. They actually had the ability to get the money from family. So that's the two issues that this bill attempts to solve, and I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Is there anybody in the audience that wants to comment on this bill?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Elbert.
Excuse me, but I also wanted to mention that this bill has been crafted and has had the great assistance from the Minnesota Realtors Association, the Minnesota Independent Community Bankers Association, Mr. Kevin Dunleavy from the Real Property Section of the Bar. Much of this language is theirs, and I want to thank them all for participating in getting this to a place where it is right now. And the Minnesota Bankers Association has seen it, as well as the Minnesota Credit Union Network, and neither they're fine with the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Any comments? Representative Holver?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two quick questions, and they're both on page 9 of the delete all. The expiration date, section 5, the reason for that?
Mr. Owen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, the reason that this bill is here is because we've got this unusual situation where property values have dramatically dropped and they're lower than the prices of the homes these days. So we believe that this is a relatively short-lived phenomenon. Prices will rise, and the Minnesota Realtors Association suggested that we put a sunset date. So if things go back to normal in a couple of years, then this is probably unnecessary.
Okay, and then if I might, Section 8 of the bill, can you tell me, it talks about a political subdivision that initiated a proceeding under Subdivision 4 or intervened under Subdivision 5. What does that relate to?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, this is... this actually should be deleted, too. This wasn't part of the bill. It was an amendment that was put on in the Senate and inadvertently captured here. It should be deleted.
Which is that?
This would be lines 9.17 through 9.25.
Mr. Chair, I would make that motion to delete that section.
Representative Hilstrom moves to delete Section 8. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
That's it, Mr.
Chair. Any more questions, Representative Westrom?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Elwood, just a quick, maybe I just missed it, but is this notice only for prices that are sold under the bank value, or in all cases will they have to send it another notice?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, thank you for the question. I know we had this discussion earlier this session. The way that's been crafted now is that there are two notices required. One gets sent out with the notice of foreclosure initially, and it's more of a general notice saying, here's where you can find out who bought your house and how much it was sold for. The second notice would be required to be given by a party with a number of exceptions who are trying to acquire the title after the bid, and that would only be required it would not be required if the price that's offered is the bid price or higher. So, yes, to some degree, your question is right.
Ms. Lee, you wanted to speak on this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International R&R Family Centers. I'm also speaking on behalf of the Asian Pacific American Consortium, made up of over 15 agencies, and also for other agencies that are not included and consumers who are affected. There's currently discussion still in process. I should also say I'm a former corporate auditor. I've been a banker, a realtor, and I'm currently a legal advocate. There's an amendment in process that we're trying to work out. It's to include unused resources that have already been paid by taxpayers' dollars, which is, besides the Homeownership Center, to add in HUD, NeighborWorks America, and the Minnesota Mortgage Prevention Association, who have different lists of agencies and counselors. NeighborWorks America was created by Congress. The board includes the governor of the Federal Reserve, who was appointed by Chairman Ben Bernanke, and HUD Assistant Secretary, appointed by President Obama. The amendment would also prevent antitrust violations that could save the taxpayers millions of dollars. And I would like to commend the Department of Commerce for their willingness to be part of the solution, because these four agencies are already in their statute 58.13. So we wanted inclusion of that.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you. Okay, is there any other discussion? Okay, then Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to pass 2699 as amended to the General Register.
It goes to Commerce.
To Commerce. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you.
Representative Olin. Is Representative Nelson in?
It's in 200.
Okay. No, we'll go with Representative Olin, then you can go get Nelson. Or they're in something? Oh, we'll go on without him. Representative Olin moves House File 3025. And I believe there's no amendments. Is that correct?
There are no amendments to this bill, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Olin, you have the second most exciting bill of the day.
Okay,
And could you just really briefly do it?
I will very briefly do it. Article 1 of this bill is a business organization section, and all of you should have a complete summary in your packets explaining in detail what exactly it does. So Article 1 is a business summary. Executive summary wanted by the State Bar Association, and Article 2 is some Secretary of State minor technical revisions. I do have two witnesses from the State Bar Association here, and I also have Bert Black from the article if anyone has questions.
I think, thank you, Representative Olin. Is there anybody that has a compelling passion to speak on this interesting subject? Okay, anybody on the committee? Okay, then Representative Olin renews his motion to pass House File 3025 and send it to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? No. Carries. Representative Hillstrom moves House File 3128. I don't see an amendment to this. Is there?
I don't believe we have an amendment.
Okay. Then go ahead. Does this go to the General Register?
I believe it's supposed to. Yes, this goes to the
thank
General
you.
Register.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, this was brought to me by the groups of folks that have been working on elder law issues and vulnerable adults, and I'd just like to turn it over to them.
Go ahead.
We are attempting to...
My understanding is this is just a technical clarification.
Right. We're attempting to clarify some of the language and
that
make
was
it
passed last
clarify
year.
That a court can...
Okay, very, very quickly then.
We're trying to clarify a court may declare a health care directive unenforceable. We're trying to streamline a process so by which the guardians and conservators submit the information to the court and establish that a ward can outline their health care wishes in a guardian or in a health care directive if the guardian does not have those powers.
Okay, thank you. Is there anybody that in the audience that wants to speak on this? Okay, any members? Representative Westrom?
Mr. Chairman, real quickly, what is driving this change? Is it going to be easy to just change somebody because you've got a fight in the family, or
no? The clarification is because the guardian before was allowed under certain circumstances to replace the healthcare agent, but it was very confusing to everyone as to when that could take place.
Thank you. Okay, no other discussion. Then Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to pass House File 3128 as amended, to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Bunn, I think I saw you. My understanding is there's peace on this one now? Okay. Representative Johnson moves House File 677. Representative Bunn, go ahead. Does this go to the General Register?
Goes to Finance, Mr. Chair.
Goes to Finance. Thank you. And I believe there's a A2 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
To this that you want to get in your shape.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Johnson moves the A2 amendment to get in the shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead, Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that you are on a tight schedule this morning. I just want to mention some people are here, so if you choose to hear from them on any particular detail, if they'd be glad to speak. From the Red Cross, we have Beth Kaufman maybe coming into the room, the president of the Red Cross in Minnesota, Jed Gorland, the medical director of Memorial Blood Bank, former speaker Steve Swigum is on the board of the Red Cross, is here with us. We have Kyle Rennell and Tom Hindlemeyer from the Health Department to answer the technical questions on the civil-related issues. And then we also have a representative of the Bardi Art community to speak to attest to their support for this form of the bill at this time. Briefly and fast, as you indicated I should be, Mr. Chair, we worked for over several years. Different versions of this legislation was attempted but failed. I saw it for the first time last year. It was a significantly flawed bill, both in terms of health and safety protection and also on some of the economic and commerce-related issues. So over the interim, we asked the Health Department to do a study. We asked the Board of Health to do a study. That information came back to us in January, some of it, or all of it, I should say. At that time, we started working with the Health Department, the Body Art community, and the Blood Bank representatives to really finalize this work for this bill and move us forward and have a good piece of legislation for our state. This bill is intended to regulate both body art establishments and body art technicians. Establishments is defined as, in a very broad way, the previous legislation overregulated, required all kinds of changes to establishments, remodels, etc. We have focused on the essential health and safety aspects. You can be licensed under this bill as a technician, as a tattooist, as a body piercer, or a dual license that does both. In both cases, the establishment and the licensee, the technician, we are focusing on the health and safety and procedural requirements to meet the national needs of the Red Cross to make sure that we have state licensure for this area. Why the public health issues? Number one, and I'll be real brief, just number one, that they can accept people who have had tattoos or body art in the last 12 months. Currently, they cannot, so it limits our blood supply. And number two, so that individual clients are protected when they enter these establishments and get safe procedures. That is our purpose. In terms of your work here in this committee, most of the bill is health and safety related, as is most all of the amendment on the fine details of that. For your committee, you might be most interested in Section 5, starting on 9.1, on grounds for denial of establishment license. What would lead to closure and reopening of the establishment? Also in Section 7, we have professional standards for disclosure of the client, that they have to get information on the client when they walk in terms of various aspects of their health status. They have to get proof of their age, because we do have age requirements for some of these procedures or permission requirements from parents. And then Section 8, which may be a focus of your interest as well, is on investigations,
Representative
actions, and
the only sections in our committee are Sections 10 and 12. So.
Well, those sections 10 and 12 are now under Section 7.
In the new bill?
Yeah, in the new
amendment.
Okay. They are on the amendment, they are 4.10 through 4.25.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Is there anybody that wants to speak on this from the audience? Okay, any discussion on the committee? Representative Fulbert?
Mr. Chair, just a quick question. I see you have a complete prohibition of tattooing under age 18, no matter with or without consent of the parent. Is that a standard across the country? Is that more restrictive?
Mm-hmm. This restriction came from the artists in the industry themselves. Most of our local, there is existing local regulation in some of our major cities and counties, like in the metro, and they already follow that practice, most of the artists. They have for a long time wanted to make sure that anything that was permanent would be at the age of an adult. In terms of a county, we looked at a couple other states, and we looked at standards that were in some of our counties currently, and they vary in terms of whether you can have it with a consent under that age or not.
But again, Mr. Chair, my question was what other states mm-hmm. have for standards. Are you aware of in the industry? Is it pretty standard across the country? Or
the health department, and possibly Kyle Ronell might know better on that when we did the review this summer.
State your name, please. And then go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'm Tom Hindlemeyer, Minnesota Department of Health, and Representative Holbrook, I don't know the answer to your question on specifically what other states do on body art for minors.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Swigum, thanks for coming. If we had more time, we'd let you, but sometimes you got a little long in the before you were speaker. So is there any other? Okay, then Representative Johnson renews his motion to pass House File 677 as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Oh, I'm sorry, to go to finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you. Representative Nelson, Chair will move House File 2231. And I believe you want the A1 amendment, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that would be nice.
All in favor of the A1 amendment to get in the shape the author wants, say yes.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you. Representative Nelson, go ahead.
Briefly, what this bill does is, because of the housing crisis that's been going on the last few years, a lot of developers have either are short of money or have gone out of business, and they have developments out there that have been partially built that, until they're actually the development's done at a certain point, they turn it over to the city. That's still considered private property, and the cities do not have the authority to go in and plow those streets. So you've got residents that are living in these unfinished developments that don't have the ability to get in out of their houses, but more importantly, fire service and ambulance service and emergency services have trouble getting in if the roads aren't plowed. This allows the cities and the townships to be able to go in and plow those streets, so that the residents that are there can get in and out, and then they can charge back to the development. The amendment we put on was brought up in the first committee. This was heard. Representative Holberg brought up the fact that it was kind of wide open authority that they could, any damage that was done, the cities would be totally not liable for it. This brings it back to a more reasonable standard where, if it's negligent act on the city, that they can be held liable for it. But just normal wear and tear and stuff, they won't be held liable for. And that's basically the brunt
Thank
of the
you.
Bill.
Is there any? My understanding is everybody's reached agreement on this. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to speak on this? Okay, anybody on the committee? Then the chair. Oh, Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, just what's in there to require a market reasonable standard or market reasonable price? So it's not $100 a foot or some outlandish number that
Representative
protection.
I don't know if there is anything that would say that in the bill. It just allows them to be able to recover their costs, so I don't believe they'd be able to charge an unreasonable price.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I don't have anything today, but would you be open to just some sort of comfort language so we've got everybody working within good faith?
Representative Nelson.
Actually, it was just pointed out to me, and I opened the bill here. I'll get it. If you look on line 1.21, under C, it says the road authority may impose a reasonable and proportionate charge. So they can't, they're not going to be able to charge an unreasonable.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, then the chair renews his motion to pass House File 2231 as amended to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Nelson, can you come back for a second? Next file, Representative Johnson moves his House File 2639. Is there any amendments to this?
There's a delete all amendment I'd like to move, Mr. Chair.
The DE4 amendment?
That's correct.
Representative Johnson moves the DE4 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, what this bill does require wireless telecom providers, otherwise known as cell phone companies, to release call location information of a missing person's cell phone to law enforcement to respond to emergencies involving the risk of death or serious physical harm. And the bill stems from a terrible tragedy that occurred in Kansas several years ago when an 18-year-old was kidnapped and murdered, and the parents wrangled with the cell phone company for 4 days in order to get the cell call location information. Once they were able to obtain it, within 45 minutes, they were able to locate the body. The state of Kansas passed a bill to deal with this issue, and that is essentially the bill we have before you. The parents of Kelsey Smith, the young lady that was kidnapped and murdered, were here to testify earlier this session, and there is some written testimony available from them. They were going to come today, but I suggested they just provide the written testimony, which you have before you. The main feature of the bill is that it uses the word in paragraph A, section 2, shall provide, rather than may provide. Federal law is what oversees cell phones by and large, and what this bill does is make it more tight via state legislation, putting in the word shall rather than may with respect to this call location information being provided. Concerning this committee, section 2, paragraph C is what's relevant. For civil law, the main point of concern, and it states that wireless telecom providers will be held harmless from court action if they act in good faith and in accordance with the provisions of this bill. So if the cell phone companies act in good faith, they can't be sued, essentially. Cell phone companies, law enforcement are all in support of this bill.
So my understanding is reach agreement with everybody on
that's
this.
Correct.
Thank you. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to speak on this? Okay, any members? Representative Hoover?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, if you know, can a consumer assert with their provider that under no circumstances will their location of their phone be disclosed?
Representative Johnson.
I don't know the answer to that question. I know we have someone from AT&T, a provider who could answer that question if he wanted to come down.
I'll ask offline.
Pardon?
I'll ask offline. I'm just wondering if the individual has the right to privacy, if they can assert that right under this program so that it's not disclosed.
Okay. Representative Western,
Mr. Chair, just related to that, Representative Johnson, it's fairly tight parameters on when they would even disclose this to authorities, and that's who they're. What and maybe you can just give us comfort. What's protecting a domestic dispute or a boyfriend-girlfriend breakup, and somebody doesn't call in and just create a false scenario or a scenario that in the end doesn't turn out to be harmful? And I know that's a little hard to predict, but what safeguards are in there so it's not just happening to anybody that wants to fax?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Westrom, I'd point to a couple things. One, it needs to be a written request, which means there'll be a formal documentation by the law enforcement agency that a request is made, so it could be followed up if there was any concerns of that sort. And they also, what we did was said that the request must come from a specific agency rather than a rogue investigative person who wasn't related to any law enforcement public agency. So it has to be both a documented written request and also from a law enforcement agency to find that information out.
Mr. Chair.
Also note that this...
Representative Johnson, go ahead. Were you finished? I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's probably sufficient.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, is it limited to just harmful scenarios, or what if law enforcement, somebody's anticipating service or process and they're trying to avoid service? Is this now going to be a tool that law enforcement could use to track down potentially a person that's in a civil dispute and potentially avoiding service or process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, it is limited to risk of death or serious physical harm to the user. If it entailed anything other than that, the cell phone company would require a warrant, for example, pursuing a drug trafficker or something of that nature.
Okay. Thanks.
Then I don't see any further discussion. Representative Johnson renews his motion to pass 2639 as amended to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon, are you still here? Yeah, there. Chair moves House File 3277, and does this go to the General Register?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Steinman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I know you have a full docket today. House File 3277 originally started as a measure to address two specific industries, locksmiths and florists. And I've been asked what the heck those two have to do with one another, and it's a good question. But both of those are industries in Minnesota and elsewhere that have been victimized by an increasingly common scam. But we've decided with an amendment that was put on the last committee to broaden this bill beyond just those two industries and to make it applicable to all industries. And here's how it works, most commonly with florists. You'll have an out-of-state florist that will pretend to be an in-state florist and will call itself, let's say, Minneapolis Flowers. And they'll even purport to have a Minneapolis address, and they'll have a 612 area code. And what will happen is a member of the public will either see an ad on the internet or in the yellow pages or elsewhere, assume, as anyone would, that they're actually patronizing a Minneapolis or local business. They'll call the number. It will be routed to the real home state, let's say New Jersey, and they'll take an order for a dozen roses for, say, $20. What they'll do is they'll turn around and they'll call a real local florist in the Twin Cities area, order the same roses that the customer ordered for $17, let's say. They'll pocket the three, and the consumer doesn't really know what's going on. So that's been happening with increasing frequency. It's a scam, and it's happening with service industries. It's happening with industries like the floral business and others. In the previous committee, we had testifiers here. I was told that given the time constraints that wouldn't be needed here. But all this is amending Minnesota's consumer statutes to make more clear what practices are prohibited and describing these particular practices. This is one of those bills, members, as a lot of others have been saying, where, you know, it kind of reveals how much we deal with false choices around here. People say you're either for jobs or the environment, or you're, you know, either for being tough on crime or you're for civil liberties. You can't be both. This is one of those additional false choices that we're often presented with. You're either pro-consumer or pro-business. This is a bill that I believe is both. The businesses want it badly, and so do consumers, because both are being ripped off.
Thank you. Is there any opposition or people from the audience that want to comment on this? Okay, anything on the Representative Paymar?
Mr. Chair, just a quick question. So, Representative Simon, so is it only dealing with out-of-state companies that are scamming, or could it also be in the state? Because that happens also, where you could have actually a business in Minneapolis that uses a St. Paul area code, and you're assuming you're getting a local company, and you're not. So how narrow is it, or does it also include those kinds of situations? Because I know similar scams that happen right here in the metro. Mm-hmm.
Representative Simon?
Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar, yes, it would include all of those. The ones that we're seeing more frequently, at least the ones that were brought to my attention in those two specific industries, were out-of-state people. But yes, it could apply to anyone who misrepresents the geographic location of their business.
Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, what implications does this have for a business that's located, say, just across the border into Wisconsin, but maybe part of that normal consumer area?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Drazkowski. You know, it would depend on the situation. Anyone who, you know, intentionally misrepresents where they're from in order to get someone to believe that they're from a place where they're actually not would be covered under this. So whether it was Wisconsin or within the state of Minnesota or New Jersey or Hawaii, they would all be included.
Representative Friscoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Simon, I guess the concern I have is some of the towns along the border, because I grew up along one, especially if on you know, the Wisconsin side, it's a rural area, and there is a an urban area on the Minnesota side, consider themselves to be part of that community, even though they're technically in the other state. Is that going to be problematic?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Drazkowski. I don't think so, because there are three different factors that any business would have to meet. We're not looking to ensnare or trap, you know, anyone who's an honest broker here. If you look at the three factors laid out in the bill, this really is aimed at people who are intentionally doing this and intentionally misrepresenting. I think I get the issue that you're talking about in border areas, but no one's going to get trapped in this who is, you know,
basically an honest broker. I should add, members, that this is patterned after legislation that's already been enacted in Oregon, in North Carolina, and in Maryland as well.
Thank you. Okay, the chair renews his motion to pass House File 3277 to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Swales. Thanks, chair will move House File 3386, and I believe we have the DE1 amendment to get it in the shape that the author wants. All in favor of the DE1 amendment to get it in that shape, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Swales, Representative Obermueller, Representative Swales, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. As you, many of you know, I have been working on a bill related to home warranties now. This is my fourth year of trying to do something as an advocate for homeowners with deficiencies in their construction. last year we presented a package of bills. I think almost all of them passed both bodies, but most of the bills were also vetoed. So as a result of all of that effort, a homeowner warranty task force was created over the summer under the purview of Dolly, and I have with me Mr. Charlie Durenberger, who was the chair of the home warranty task force. So out of the work of that task force, this particular bill was created, and I'm just briefly going to go through some of the basic agreements that have been worked out. I want to also say before I begin describing the bill that there has been considerable conversation up to last Friday from both sides. I met with two attorneys representing homeowners on Thursday who had major concerns about the bill. So on Friday, I called together all of the players and facilitated a three-hour conversation up in 300 South, where we talked. I had two members representing the Builders Association, two of their attorneys. I had two attorneys representing the homeowners. I had Mr. Durenberger there. I had Representative Obermueller and Representative Simon. And all of us worked through section by section, line by line, and came to consensus on every section of the bill. And when we finished, I can assure you there was pain all around the room because of the concessions made, but there was an agreement that we had finally come up with a product that we think will benefit homeowners in the long run. So very quickly, to just describe what is in the bill, the VINDI gives notice of Section 327 of a 327A defect to the defender or to the vendor, who is the developer who constructs the dwelling for the purposes of the sale. The vendee must allow inspection of the claim defects. The vendor must perform the inspection within 30 days of notice of claim. The vendor must repair any invasive testing. That means they must make the house whole if they had to tear open a hole in order to verify that there was a problem. The statute of limitations is told during statutorily required notice, inspection, offer of repair, and dispute resolution process. Within 15 days of inspection, the vendor must make an offer of repair. If the vendor does not inspect, make an offer of repair, or perform the repair, the vendee can sue the vendor. If the parties agree on the scope of repair work, the vendor will perform it. If the parties don't agree on the scope of repair, then they proceed to the homeowner dispute resolution process. And this is probably the new mechanism that will keep a lot of this out of the court system and save money to both parties. Unless the vendor hasn't inspected or not made an offer to repair, the vendee cannot sue until the dispute resolution process has been completed or 60 days after the vendor has made its offer of repair. The Department of Labor and Industry will create a list of qualified neutrals for the homeowner dispute resolution process. The dispute resolution process is started by notice of the vendee or vendor to the Dolly commissioner. Within 10 days of being given notice, Dolly will send the vendor and vendee a list of three neutrals. If the parties cannot agree on which neutral to use, the vendor will strike one neutral, the vendee will strike another, and the remaining neutral will serve as the neutral.
In the interest of time, I think we don't need the dispute resolution. I think you've hit all the important parts.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I just invite Mr. Dornberger at least to explain what the task force did and part of their work?
30 seconds.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Charlie Dornberger. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. And as Representative Swales indicated, the governor vetoed the bill that required or allowed homeowners to recover attorney's fees, but asked that our department lead a discussion among interested parties in finding solutions for homeowners and builders to resolve their warranty disputes short of litigation. So I put together a group of people that I knew from my experience in 20 years of working with homeowner complaints across the spectrum to try to get together. We started meeting in August of last year on a monthly basis, accelerated it in February, and basically what you see here today is a result of issues that we came to consensus on. There's still issues that we're going to continue to meet on to resolve, but this represents the consensus that we reached in February.
And my understanding is Representative Obermiller was part of that group. I see somebody from the builders, but I don't know that anybody... Is there anybody in the audience that wants to speak on this? My understanding is there's a complete agreement for this part of it. Not that you're done, but for this bill. Okay, then don't see any further. Then the chair renews his motion to.
Chair.
Oh, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a question on Section 10 on the requirement of the report. Why do we believe that's necessary at this point in time?
Mr. Dornberger?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, one of the concerns that the homeowners expressed in the task force was a lack of statistics in this area. We really don't know how many homeowners have complaints against their builder based on warranty issues from year to year and how they get resolved. And so this was one way that we tried to capture some actual statistics so that everybody that's interested in this issue can find out, you know, how many of these cases do we have every year and how do they get resolved?
Okay, then the chair renews his motion to pass House File 3386 as amended, and it goes to General Register's mind. No, it goes
Mr.
to Congress.
Mr. Chair, it needs to go to the Commerce
Committee. I'm sorry, goes to Congress. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Lesch. The chair will move House File 776, and this goes to the General Register, is my understanding.
Yeah. Roger that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
Members, this is an update to the Uniform Foreign Country Money Judgments Recognition Act. Those are a lot of words, but the version is a 1962 version. Minnesota passed it in 1985. There have been no updates since then, and as people well know, with the movement toward a global economy, a lot of changes have occurred in that time that require us to update and modify this, which, of course, the do-gooders down at the Uniform Laws Commission have caught on to and made sure that we catch up with. So, in thanks to them and in deference to the expert on this, Mr. Tennyson, I'll defer to him in explaining the 5 points of this, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Tennyson, really quick.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what this does is provide some procedures, in a nutshell, it provides some procedures that are not currently explicit in the law. It clarifies some provisions that were confusing before. Sometimes, and it makes clear that this only applies to judgments from foreign countries, not from foreign states. Mr. Chairman, that's basically it.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to speak on this uniform law that is maybe the third most exciting bill of the day? Okay, anybody on the committee? Okay, the chair renews his motion to send House File 776 to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Jackson, do you want to do your two bills?
Sure.
Representative Jackson moves House File 3147. Mm-hmm. And I believe there's an amendment to this. Isn't, or is this the... Oh, there isn't, I guess. Oh, this is the first you have... It's already put into the first engrossment. Representative Jackson, let's go to the General Register. Oh, no, it goes to taxes.
No, General
doesn't
Register,
it?
According to
oh,
the packet.
Oh, okay. Does Ann know about that? Okay. Representative Jackson, go ahead.
I move passage of House File 3147 with a referral to the General Register. And, you know, I have the the Ramsey County assessor here, Mr. Baker, in case there are questions, but in sum, a 1993 statute intended to cure moonlighting by county assessors has been read by the court to mean that county assessors cannot testify for the county at property tax appeals. And that's created quite a problem for counties who either don't have the budget to hire private appraisers or are spending a lot of money doing it. It was not the intention, and I've looked into it deeply enough to satisfy myself that, in fact, the 1993 legislative intent was simply to cure the moonlighting of assessors in their own jurisdiction. And so this bill would allow reports to be prepared and county assessors to testify on behalf of their county in a property tax appeal.
And Representative Jackson, the court decision decided not to look at the legislative history, which was really clear exactly as you said. So is there anybody in the audience that wants to speak on this? Okay, Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jackson, just so when you refer to moonlighting, you're talking about doing appraisal services?
Correct.
And so can they do appraisal services outside of their jurisdiction? And now, first question, second question, then to clarify, they can testify or do appraisal type work for the county for a trial or a dispute.
Representative Jackson.
Representative Mulray. Representative Westrom, yes, if a county assessor is also licensed as an appraiser, he or she may do appraisals outside of his or her jurisdiction. However, many of them, as a practice, don't in the surrounding counties because they may find themselves in an adversarial position to the next-door county assessor, and they usually have a cooperative relationship. So while they can, they don't normally.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, Representative Jackson renews her motion to pass House File 3147, send it to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Jackson moves House File 3393. Another one of the exciting bills for today. The MCIOWA. And for once, we don't see David Ide. Representative Jackson, go ahead.
I move House File number 3393 for referral to the General Register. With me, I have Mr. Tom Bray from the Bar Association. And these are very technical changes, and I would love to pass it right off to Mr. Bray.
Representative Jackson, first you move your A1 amendment to get it the shape you want.
Yes, I first
all in favor,
A1
say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
All right, now
go ahead.
State your name. 3393 as amended.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Bray, B-R-A-Y. I'm the vice chair of Mr. Ide's committee. He's enjoying the sun in Arizona right now and couldn't be with us. House File 3393 amends the Minnesota Common Interest Ownership Act, which governs condominiums, cooperatives, and planned communities, including townhomes. The amendment addresses concerns raised by members of the bar and other interested parties over the last several years. The amendments deal primarily with resolution of inconsistencies and clarifications of ambiguities in the existing statute. There are a few more substantive provisions, and I'd be happy to go through those if the committee would like. I would like to say that the bill was circulated to over 20 interested parties, including the Community Association Institute, which is a trade organization of homeowners associations. It was circulated to the Minnesota Association of Realtors, the Association of County Surveyors, and we have not had any opposition to the bill.
Is there anybody in the audience terribly excited about the MCIOWA?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Westerman.
Mr. Chair, we really, I think, deserve a little better description of what we're trying to change here. Rather than just say there's no controversy, I'd like to know a little bit more.
Okay, and I'll give you examples of some of the substantive provisions in the bill. we've amended Section 2-109 of the Act, and it's on page 21 of the bill, basically to codify a licensing procedure that has been used by practitioners for quite a while to allocate parking areas within common interest communities. We are amending Section 2-118, which is on page 31 of the bill. That was a change that was requested by the Community Association Institute to make it easier for existing homeowners associations who want to amend their governing documents but who are having difficult times getting responses from mortgagees to basically provide a written notice to a mortgagee. The mortgagee has 60 days to respond to the notice. If the mortgagee does not respond within the 60 days, then they're deemed to have approved the amendment. We've also, another significant amendment was to Section 3-114 on page 65, which clarifies the standards which an association must follow in establishing replacement reserves. That's another area where there has been some problems lately with associations having underfunded reserves. I can go through more sections if the committee would like.
I think that's pretty much the main parts of it. Okay, is there any further discussion of this before we go ahead? Okay, then Representative Bullock Jackson renews her motion to pass House File 3393 to the
as amended
to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Morrow, I think I saw Representative Morrow. The chair will move House File 3117.
Mr. Chair, I do have two bills on the agenda. I could do 3117
first.
We're
going to do 3117 first. Representative Morrow, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair and members, this is a bill related to motor carrier contract indemnification. Specifically, it deals with the trucking industry and what's called anti-indemnification language. And what this bill does is... And I'm going to have my testifier talk briefly about it. Would this allow such agreements as running contrary to public policy? I'll have Adam Chelseth talk very briefly from the Minnesota Trucking Association why this agreement is needed. What I will say is that this bill has moved through each committee without objection, and I know of no objection at this point. But I will turn, Mr. Chair, to Mr. Chelseth with your permission.
Chelsea? Okay. Can you go ahead briefly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Adam Chelseth, Minnesota Trucking Association. Very briefly, I'm going to actually allow Keith Klein to talk more fully about this issue, but I will say that the legislation you have before you is something that 17 other states have successfully pursued, and our neighbor to the south, Iowa, is actually going to be signing this into law very soon. So what we're doing here is kind of learning from the lessons of others, and there's actually precedent in statute right now for this kind of legislation. About 5 to 10 years ago, the legislature actually made certain indemnification clauses void and unenforceable in Section 33702 dealing with building and construction contracts. So, as I said, we're trying to kind of follow that pattern. And with that, I would turn it over to Chairman of our board, Keith Klein, to discuss the bill in a little more detail.
State your name and not in very much more detail, because I'm understanding from everybody there's complete agreement on this one.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm Keith Klein. I'm chairman of the Minnesota Trucking Association, also executive vice president and chief operating officer of Transport American Egan. Maybe just one example of where this could come into play. We had a situation where we had a trailer going down the road that a customer had loaded with big totes of paint. The totes weren't loaded securely and tipped over. Unfortunately, the paint leaked out the back of the trailer going down the road and painted some cars behind. If this language would had been in place on a customer contract, it would have been our liability, because we would have held the customer harmless for their negligence in that process. And it's those kind of examples that we're trying to avoid in the process. I've got a lot more statement, but I'll turn it back and be available to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Attorney discussion. Representative Westman.
So, Mr. Chair, to that example, you're saying you'd be held harm, you'd be liable as the trucking company instead of the company that loaded it improperly?
Mr. Chair, that would be correct in that case. With the provision in the contract, if the provision was in there that said there's a one-way indemnification clause, basically that language would say the shipper is held harmless for their own negligence, and the trucking company has to hold them harmless in that case, regardless of whose fault and whose negligence it was in the process. All we're trying to do is make those clauses that shift that responsibility, make those null and void in a contract, so that we each would share our own responsibility. We have no issue indemnifying them for our own negligence. If we do something wrong, they shouldn't have to pay, but we don't want to indemnify them for their own negligence.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I'm understanding it. If you're shifting more responsibility to the trucker, I happen to have a lot of truckers in my district. They complain to me all the time about companies basically running the show, and that they get to tell you when you're going to unload. They get to tell you how you're going to unload it, and et cetera, et cetera. I don't know why we would shift more burden to the trucker, who's independent, who works for a company like yours, who whatever is often not in a position of strength to bargain, and mostly takes it on the chin. Why would we shift more liability to you as a trucker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, we're actually doing the reverse. We're actually making a more level playing field by not allowing these one-way indemnification agreements. This bill is actually in favor of the very position that you're describing. It would hold the shipper responsible for the shipper's negligence rather than having the shipper force the motor carrier into a contract absolving the shipper of all responsibility.
Okay.
This is good for the truckers.
Oh, very good. I misunderstood the testimony then.
Representative Westrum, it's the Truckers Association protecting themselves. Seeing no further, the chair renews his motion to pass House File 3117 and send it to General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Representative Jackson moves House File 3300. Representative Mora, where is this one going now?
Well, Mr.
Chair, to the General Register?
I think it's going to the General Register at this point.
Do we have two amendments left now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Representative Jackson moves the A3 amendment to partially get it in the shape of the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Morrow, Representative Jackson moves the A5 amendment to get it in the final shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Morrow, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, the A3 and the A5 amendments now bring this bill into a form that all parties that have been testifying now agree to this bill. That includes the County Attorney Association, which has been very helpful over the past week in making some needed corrections. And I appreciate the County Attorney's help. This bill, members, deals with the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. This is policy language brought by the department. It does a couple of major things, or primary things. One, it changes definitionally the term client to the term civilly committed sex offender. This is language that the House passed last year. This language did not make it into law. My understanding is the governor's office also requests this change. This is a change in terminology primarily directed toward external communications. This does not change anyone's rights or responsibilities. Rather, just makes it clear there was some concern that the word client was not the appropriate word to use. Second, members, this makes changes in Statute Area 253B. Statute 253B was originally drafted for mentally ill and mentally ill and dangerous populations. That language wasn't always exactly appropriate for the the SDP and the SPP populations. I'll let Dr. Sheila Brandt talk very briefly about the changes in 253 and what this bill does in terms of things such as the aftercare program that the MSOP program is creating.
Sorry, Representative Mark. Go ahead. State your name and go ahead.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Dr. Sheila Brandt, and I'm the Legislative and Stakeholder Relations Director for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. You have the language in front of you, as well as a summary sheet that covers the primary changes in 253B. to echo what Representative Morrow has already stated, these changes have been worked on not only by MSOP, also by State Operated Services, and by the county attorneys, and we have consensus on these changes. Without going into all the details, again, because those are in front of you, I would just highlight, in addition to what Representative Morrow has already indicated, that the changes that are made to 253B are more related, they're more technical and housekeeping in terms of taking some of the things from the MIND population, that part of the statute, and bringing it over to our section of the statute so it's more self-contained, reduces some of the cross-referencing, and is easier for use. We've cleaned up some of the language about things that don't really apply to this population that may have worked well and continue to work well for the population of individuals committed as mentally ill and dangerous. For example, one of the things you'll see is related to revocation. Currently, the statute allows for if someone's on provisional discharge and they were engaging in behavior and not complying with their plan, they could be revoked, and they would receive a telephone call indicating that they were going to be revoked. We do not believe that that population or that procedure works well for individuals that we treat because it increases the chance for absconding. So things like that are in front of you. We also have worked with the county attorneys to clean up some of the language about aftercare services, and you'll see from the materials in front of you that MSOP wants to and will assume responsibility and accountability for all case management services, clinical supervision of this population, and any ongoing aftercare needs. Aside from that, I'm available for any questions that the committee may have.
Is there anybody, I think, is it Mr. Kerwin in the audience? Did you want to speak? My understanding is that the county attorneys are okay with this language right now, for now.
That's correct.
Thank you. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two quick questions. What was your title again?
Chair and Representative Paymar, my name is Dr. Sheila Brandt, and I'm the Legislative and Stakeholder Relations Director. I know, it's a mouthful.
You're the what?
Representative.
Chair and Representative Paymar and Committee, I'm the Legislative and Stakeholder Relations Director.
What does that mean? What do you do?
Representative Paymar.
Chair and Committee and Representative Paymar, I serve as a liaison with the MSOP, as does other liaisons that DHS has, for example, Continuing Care, SOS, Child and Family. They all have liaisons. So I work in that capacity to help prepare legislation on behalf of MSOP. I serve as a resource for the legislatures. So when you have questions or concerns about sex offender policy, our program can range from anything that's empirical in nature because of my clinical background training or procedural about the program. The stakeholder piece, which I'm just getting into, is more related to the prevention efforts that MSOP wants to become more involved in. So networking with our stakeholders, whether it's folks that we may consider unlikely stakeholders, prosecutors, defense attorneys, sheriff's associations, but also county attorney associations, MnCASA, other victim advocates groups. So MSOP wants to be at the table to help move our policy discussion ahead.
Quick question, Mr. Chair. So all of the language related to the provisional discharge plans and reviews and revocation, is this under the assumption that there's actually going to be a discharge at some point?
Chair and Representative Paymar, as we all know, the courts make that decision, although we make recommendations about a client's progress in treatment. And yes, that's correct. We believe that it's important that the courts could make that decision at any point in time. And it's very important that we are planful and can illustrate clearly what the standards are and what will occur when that back door is intentionally and planfully open.
Okay, seeing no further questions then, let's see, was it Representative Jackson? Representative Jackson renews her motion to pass House File 3300 as amended and send it to General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Representative Welty, Chair moves House File 2766. And while you're coming down, it's my understanding that you're withdrawing 2920. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. We have reached an agreement on House File 2920.
Thank you. Go ahead on 2766.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 2766 proposes to add the words mental health to some statute that allows higher education institutions to contact proper family members or proper individuals if an individual has a mental health emergency. Currently in statute, if you look at the definition, it doesn't clearly spell out that mental health is included in safety or health emergencies, and there has been some difference in how this is treated in across our higher institutions in the state. And so we just want to make sure that it's clear and that higher educations know that in common practice that they would be allowed to make the contacts. With me today is Sue Abderholden. She is here on behalf of the National Alliance of Mental Illness, and she will describe to you how this came about. But I do want you all members to know that this legislation was thoroughly vetted with the University of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota said that this is common practice for them, and they have no issues with the bill. Also, we vetted it out with the Minnesota State College Student Association and the University of Minnesota Student Association. Both organizations have said that they are okay with the bill. We also vetted this out with the MinSCU system, and they have signed off on the language as well. So all interested parties have been notified of this language and are okay with the language.
Thank you. Ms. Abderholden, let me see if there's any opposition first. Is there any opposition to any this? From anybody? Okay, then give the very shortened version of it, 30 seconds.
Mr. Chairman, members, Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota, very briefly, this just makes sure that colleges treat a mental health emergency as they would any other healthcare emergency. It came out of the Virginia Tech shootings. This is in line with the new federal regulations, does not allow access to medical records. It simply is allowing a college to notify a parent under any situation that perhaps their son or daughter is suicidal or is in danger of hurting themselves or others.
Seeing no questions from the panel, then the chair renews his motion to pass 2766 and send it to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
All right, the next bill we have for consideration is House File 3137. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Move your bill.
And this goes to the General Register, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, basically all we're doing is adding a chemical use screening to the mental health screening when a youth is in the juvenile system. We want to find out as soon as possible if they have any chemical addictions so that we can start getting them treated right away. That's the best way to stop them from further crime. And we have Cheryl Krager from the Juvenile Justice Coalition this morning.
Hi, good morning. My name is Cheryl Krager. I'm the Associate Director with the Juvenile Justice Coalition in Minnesota. And really briefly, this legislation came out of our substance abuse group, which has 100 individuals on the email list, 20 active members representing the chemical health field, juvenile justice, education, human services. And basically, like Representative Mullery said, we're just adding to do a chemical use screening for kids when they come into the system. The current screening tool is approved by the Department of Human Services to do the mental health screen, also can be used to do the chemical health screen. So there's no new screening tools, no new costs, no new procedure, process. It's all the same. We just want to recognize that this screening tools identify both issues for kids and that the system then responds appropriately.
All right, Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And who's going to pay for the screening?
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, the mental health screening, it's already being paid for, reimbursed. The counties get reimbursed through the state, so there's no additional cost. We're already doing the screening, so it's part of the already procedure.
I don't understand how there wouldn't be any additional cost if you're... It sounds like you're adding more individuals or young or juveniles who would be required to get assessed.
President Paymar, Madam Chairman, yes, that might end up, but basically what we're trying to do is identify the kids early with chemical use issues, but they would follow the same procedure. And when I talked to the Department of Human Services, they don't actually anticipate much higher numbers. I'm not sure how to explain it, but we may end up assessing more kids with chemical use, but that actually would save us in the long run. So, prevent them from getting into the system further.
Well,
Representative Paymar.
How much does it cost to do a CD assessment?
Representative Paymer, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, it's the counties already do the assessment, so if a youth is identified with a chemical health issue on the screen, they would refer to the counties. They would do the assessment as part of their normal process, or they would access a third-payer party, their child's insurance. So.
Representative Paymer. I don't want to labor the point, but I understand, but if you're going to require, and I think this is a good idea, but if you're going to add more juveniles to get the assessment, it seems to me either the county or the state is going to be picking up additional costs.
Madam Chair,
Representative Mallory,
I was wrong that this doesn't go to the general register. It goes back to
safety policy,
public safety, and in the meantime maybe Representative Paymar can get those questions answered by somebody like the department that could
have
accurate knowledge.
Right. Thank you.
Since it's going back to public safety tomorrow.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious what the the red flags are for testing a child for chemical dependency. It seems that there should be some due process there. It doesn't seem like that's being adhered to.
Representative, Madam Chairwoman, the screening tool, what it does is just ask questions of the kids at that moment in time. So things like, were you drinking last weekend? Is alcohol affecting your life? That kind of thing. Are you having struggles in school? Kind of just those general questions. And then if they get scored a certain way on the screening tool, a certain level, then that will kind of identify those red flags. And then they get referred for the chemical health assessment, when that part actually really identifies if they have a chemical use issue, the severity of that, and then recommendations for treatment and follow-up. So the screen just kind of asks general questions to see if maybe there is some concerns and we need to follow up.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I may have missed it, but could you tell us exactly how the consent from the parent would happen in these situations?
Ms. Krieger.
Madam Chairman, Representative, it's my understanding that the folks who do the screening, the corrections staff, they contact the parents and ask them for their permission before they conduct the screen with the kids. So, I'm assuming they call them by phone, or so. Otherwise, they can't do the screen on the children. So.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it would simply be a verbal consent, or would there be a written consent?
Ms. Krieger.
Sure. Madam Chairman, I'm not 100% sure on that. I can double check on that. I don't conduct the screen, so I would have to check on that to make sure.
And perhaps we can find that out before this comes before the next committee.
Tomorrow.
All right. Any other questions? No further discussion. Does anyone else wish to testify on this bill? All right. Seeing no one, Representative Mallory renews his motion that House File 3137 be passed and referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move that House File 1557, and this is Mike Nelson's bill, and I've talked to him about it. It's a bill that it's related to the same subject as we passed out of here a week and a half ago, a my bill. And all, unfortunately, the Senate bill didn't get in time. And so he's agreed to just substitute the language we passed on my bill. And I've given it to the Republican staff, and they've met with their members. And so everybody seems to be agreeable. All we're doing is putting the language that we passed onto his bill so that it has a Senate companion.
All right. Any discussion or questions?
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Where is House File 1557?
It's in our committee.
But do we have a copy of it? Do we know what it's about? Or?
Well, Representative Holberg, what it's about is It's about the same issue. It's the this is the one that we had on the time for appeal to the district court from the last action by a city board of zoning appeals. And then there was a provision for a bond, and the two sides have reached agreement. That came up when maybe you're remembering my, now that I'm bringing it out. Two sides reached agreement on the length of time for the appeal to the district court, and then they had reached agreement that there wouldn't be a damages bond. So it was shortened from 6 years to 180 days to go to district court, and in return, there was an agreement there wouldn't be a damages bond. So that's what it does.
And Madam Chair and
Representative Holberg,
Chair Mullery, the language on your bill was shared with us. My question is the what I believe you said was the Nelson bill, what that was about. We don't have a copy of it in our files. Is it germane to that bill, or are we just picking up a...
That's what I just said. It was, it reduced it. It would have reduced from 6 years to 60 days, and it would have required a bond.
So
the agreement is to reach an agreement in between on the number of days and not having a bond.
Madam Chair.
Representative Holberg?
Just the exact same issue.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Mullery, are you doing a delete everything onto
yes.
the Nelson bill? So the Nelson bill will not exist in that
right.
form. It will just be the language we're doing, but you're putting it on that bill.
Exactly.
Does that help?
And Mr. or Madam Chair and Chair Mullery,
Holberg.
It's just a little unusual not to have the bill that, you know, so I was trying to figure out what that bill was, not having a copy of it, but you say it's germane, so we might as well run with it, I guess.
It's totally germane. My bill was the agreement between the two parties after he introduced his last year. So.
Gail?
All
right. All right, we have House File 1557 before us. You should also have a sheet of paper marked House File 3469. I believe Representative Mullery is making a motion to substitute this as a delete all amendment.
Right.
So this is the language, and everyone has it in front of them. Does anyone have questions about this? Okay. First engrossment of House File 3469. The language of that will be substituted as a delete all amendment onto House File 1557.
Right.
So this language will thereby be
right.
renumbered.
Right.
All right. Then, let's see. Any more discussion to the amendment? Hearing none, all in favor of Representative Mullery's amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion passes. Now, any further discussion on the bill? Anyone wishing to testify in favor or in opposition?
Well, and Madam Chair, I would just assume that the chair, given that House File 1557 wasn't on the agenda or the other one, if there are any concerns and people figure out what happened today, that Representative Mullery would address them before bringing it up on the floor.
Do we have that assurance, Representative
yes.
Mullery?
Madam Chair. Yes.
Thank you. Any further questions or discussion? All right, seeing no further discussion, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 1557, as amended, be passed and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes. All right, Representative
Mark Wart.
Oh, Mark Wart. All right. House File 3085.
Representative Markworth.
Thank you very much.
I recall this is a very simple bill, just there was apparently a mistake made last time. Go ahead and explain your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. And I think that this can be moved to the General Register. I don't think it has to come back to taxes unless it needs to go somewhere else. Mr. Michaels thought it could go Right, the general
right to the
register.
General register.
That would be my preference. But at any rate, Mr. Chair, what
Representative Kulik-Jackson then moves the file to go to the general register.
Thank you very much.
Oh, and there's an amendment.
Oh, yes, Mark. There is a delete all amendment.
Representative Jackson moves the DE2 amendment to get in the shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and you're exactly right. What we're trying to do is clean up an inadvertent mistake from last year. Last year in the public safety finance bill, it was a bill again with insurance companies. And insurance companies, if they had to pay a claim to a policyholder, what they were doing is instead of paying the claim, they were holding on to that money and putting it into an account that would gain a higher interest rate, because when they had to pay it back, it was at a 4% interest rate penalty. So they're actually making money by holding the money and not giving it back to the policyholder. So what they did in the public safety finance bill is they raised that percentage for large insurance companies on any awards over $50,000 to 10%. The intent was just to apply to insurance companies. Well, what it did is it ended up applying to all awards in Chapter 549.09. So now all of a sudden, all of these interest rates went up to 10%. And these are all of the other provisions in law that it applied to. But for example, it would be an interest rate on pollution control violations. Interest rates on property tax appeals or delinquent property taxes or tax forfeited land. So what this amendment does, it says on any award for or against a public entity. So it could also be an individual property owner. Let's say I lose in property tax court and my market value goes up and I have to pay $100,000 or whatever, that 10% would apply to me. This brings all of those down back to what past law was, which was 4%. So it keeps the insurance companies at 10%, which was the intent, and brings everyone else back to, well, it's not 4% always. It's set at whatever the Treasury bond rate is. It's kind of a adjustable rate every year, but right now it'd be 4%. So I do have Keith Carlson here from the Minnesota Inter-County Association if you have any questions.
I think you've pretty well explained it. Is there any opposition to it? Representative Holberg, did you have a question?
I did have a question. So from what you said, the attempt was is to get at insurance companies. So now that it inadvertently affected political subdivisions in the state, and you're fixing that, but what other entities outside of political subdivisions in the state that aren't insurance companies does it affect as well? In other words, does this affect child support payments that are in arrears? Does it, I mean, are we, it sounds like the political subdivisions came in and saved themselves, but was the inadvertence applied to everything? Have we left other categories or organizations or sets of people under this onerous 10% that were not intended?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, delinquent child support is a judgment, and it is paid to the court rather than directly to the individual. So my understanding would be that the reduction in the interest rate from the new law 10% back to the floating rate, which is currently 4%, would apply to those delinquent payments.
Well, and Mr. Chair, maybe that was a bad example, but I mean, as I heard you explain the bill, it was put into account to try and get insurance companies to pay up. Have we set up a situation where other people are sucked into the 10% inadvertently that aren't being addressed in this resolution here?
Representative.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, the intent here, and I guess if someone can correct me, was to basically separate it, everything else away from that insurance. So whatever else that it applied to that deals with Chapter 549.09, which are awards and judgments and interest, it should go back to the way it was. So I guess I that's...
I mean, I Mr. Chair, the average person doesn't have the AMC or League of Minnesota Cities. Or, I mean, it looks like we took care of the people that have lobbyists down here, but did we take care of the average citizen?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the bill has originally introduced only took care of eminent domain awards and property tax appeals. With the delete all amendment, it applies to all situations where either an individual, a business, owes something to state or local government, or vice versa, state or local government owes something to an individual or business.
But, Mr. Chair, what if they owe it to each other?
Mr. President, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, it is not addressed. We ran it by the original proponents of last year's legislation, and they were satisfied that it kept their intent intact. So this only addresses, again, where amounts are owed to state or local government or are owed by state or local government.
Representative Hillstrom and then Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify that this was a Representative Smith provision, and we did hear it in the policy committee. It ended up in the finance bill, but it was our intent to get at the insurance companies. And so I think that, you know, I'd be happy to chat with Representative Smith to make certain that we, you know, do what he intended and not leave anybody out in this fix.
Representative Holland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe this, the intent of this part isn't just to favor the people that can afford a lobbyist, because it says for or against the interest rate. So if you got a judgment against the county or against the state, the township or city, or they got one against you, neither way are you paying those interest rates. So it doesn't just go one way. It says for or against.
And, Mr. Chair, I understand that, but is there any instance under this chapter where it's two private parties that are affected and there is no subdivision? And Mr. Carlson appears to be ready for the phone a friend on this issue.
Mr. Joel Carlson. In Minnesota, it gets difficult. On Carlson's.
Land of Sun. Johnson, Carlson. Mr. Chair and members, I'm Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and this was an initiative that took us a couple of years to work through the legislative process. And to your question, Representative Holberg, the interest rate on judgments over $50,000 would apply to all civil judgments. But it was not our intention to deal with tax appeals, eminent domain, and other judgments, payments to or judgments against the government. So I think they've got it right, and we don't oppose this legislation, but Minnesota at 4% has the lowest post-judgment interest rate in the country, and there is a disincentive to pay those awards, and that's why we brought it to what is the average in the country at 10%. And so we didn't, the legislature didn't provide for a radically wild interest rate. That is what the average across the country was, as we were able to determine it. Like Wisconsin is a flat 12% on all judgments. We didn't feel it was fair on judgments that were smaller, where there's less incentive to not pay than larger judgments. And so that's why that number was picked and the 50,000 was picked. But it would apply in an instance where there are just two civil litigants. I can tell you that much of that is driven by insurance. But if you just did have two private parties, the concept is the same, the interest would be the same. And it's not common, but that would that potentially could happen. And it does not apply to child support.
Okay, seeing or Representative Kelly?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I understand that the intent was to go after the insurance companies to get people to pay their award on time. Why shouldn't this apply to everyone? Why shouldn't it apply to individuals? Why shouldn't it apply to government? If it certainly was a judgment. Apparently, it was a penalty or tax that should have been paid. Why aren't we giving the incentive to everyone to pay their bills on time?
Mr. Joel Carl.
Well,
Mr. Chair and Representative Kelly, and that certainly could be a topic of debate. But what we're trying to do is clean up what was inadvertently done from last year. And I don't disagree that could be a topic of debate, but that's not what we're trying to do here. We're just trying to put it back to what was the intent of last year's bill.
Okay, then seeing no further. Okay, Representative Jackson renews her motion to pass 3085 as amended and send it to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
Carried. No.
Representative McFarland. Chair moves.
Members, House, thank you very much.
Chair moves House File 3528. And Representative McFarland. And I.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an A1 amendment. Was it in your packet? I understand it was passed out back there.
Back there? Wasn't in my packet.
I can talk about it while we're.
Why don't you go ahead and talk about it?
Mr. Chair, this is part of the House File 3495, and it's the section about the data. We wanted to take it out and have it run separately also, and this is for the Office of Higher Education, and I'd like Tricia Grimes from the office to speak to this.
Ms. Grimes.
Mr. Chair, Tricia Grimes from the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. What you're seeking here is the authority to do data matching among data the agency already collects. We would not be collecting new data, and we would not be releasing individualized data, but we would be analyzing data within the office. Particularly, we'd be matching data between our enrollment database and our student financial aid program databases that we use to calculate awards for individual students. And one of the goals of this is to be able to do research projects such as do state grant recipients persist in college at the same rate as those who do not receive a state grant, and those kinds of analyses to evaluate our programs.
Okay. Is there any questions from the audience, or anyone wants to testify from the audience?
Mr. Chair, do you want me to speak to the amendment?
I guess all of the amendments weren't out.
The amendment is now out. So a chair will move the A1 amendment to get in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative.
Wait a minute, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Could I get the A1 amendment?
It's coming. I'm sorry. I thought they were all copied.
Well, I think they're bringing them around. I don't have an A1 amendment.
Can we read it while we're waiting?
That's because bringing them down.
Representative McFarland, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I think it would be best for
Ms. Grimes. Do you want to?
Mr. Chair, we've been working with Representative Holberg, and she's raised some very good questions. And this amendment would list the various data sets that we plan to use in doing this data matching.
And Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Holberg.
You know, this list of the databases that they're using. My issue was, are you going to use Social Security numbers? Are you going to use student grades? Are you going to, you know, that was kind of my. So I think there's still more work to do, but we. I'm not trying to stop the bill today or anything, but this blanket authority that we continue to give organizations with computerized databases and all the stuff, there's really no. I mean, the bill as written is quite broad. They're not coming back every time they want to do a new study. And so as public policymakers, my point is that we should know what elements of data they're using for these studies and whether or not we think that that's a good idea.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Grimes.
Representative Holberg, we would like to continue to work with you on your concerns and see if we could come up with language that would address those concerns as the bill proceeds. One of our hesitations is that I was just sitting here waiting for the bill to be heard. I came up with 24 different data elements, and I haven't even gone back to the office. I think there would be hundreds, and we were concerned about the prospect of setting ourselves up to have to ask for legislation every time we wanted to add a data element.
And, Mr. Chair, that is exactly my concern.
Right.
This is what's happening all over the place with data that government entities and their agents are keeping on individuals, and we give this blanket authority, And I don't think people understand that when they fill out a financial aid form so to see whether or not their kid can get financial aid, that at some point their family income, whether their siblings in the house, what neighborhood they live in, what color their skin is, all end up in some study of higher ed, whatever. And maybe for some people in this room, that's great, and they don't have any problem with it. But where we see this happening and how frequently, and the broad language that all these entities keep coming in and asking for, I have concerns. Others may not.
Maybe Ms. Grimes could tell the intent of the information.
Ms. Grimes?
Well, the intent of the information, for example, from time to time we get questions, often there are questions from the legislature about whether the effectiveness of the Minnesota State Grant Program, which is the program that main program the state uses to help students pay for college if they're lower middle income. And one of the things they want to know is, do those students finish their degrees? This kind of data matching would enable us to do that kind of analysis, is whether students finish their degrees at the same rate.
And Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Holberg, you're absolutely correct. The amount of data that's being compiled upon students, insurance companies, the amount of data out there is just phenomenal on how they can tell what we're doing, where we're doing it, and when we're doing it, and why we're doing it. And I wholeheartedly support your attempt to rein some of this in. So thank you for all the hard work that you do, and this is the amendment that you think is the right thing to do. I'm more than willing to work
Mr. Chair, again, this amendment lays out the various databases they're using, which that should concern people to begin with. Look at all the databases that they have access to. But my thing is are we going to let them use Social Security numbers? Are we going to let them use household data? Are we and she just said that she can probably come up with 100 different data sets that they have access to. Well, let's see the list of 100 data sets. How much information do you have access to, and should you be using all of those components for research? I don't know. It doesn't surprise me that you testify that there's 100 different things that you could know about each individual student.
Okay, my understanding is everybody's willing to let it go. So the chair renews his motion to pass House File 3528 as amended to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. 2-0. Okay. arousing support for your bill.
Yeah.
I think there were two, one or two. with that, members, we have Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Realizing this is our last meeting, would just like to, as the minority, would like to thank you, Mr. Chair, for your cooperative demeanor and just the collegiality that we've had throughout the short time we've had here over the last couple months.
Thank you very much, and I want to thank everybody on both sides for working together so well to get this done. This morning's a real example of working together. Thank you all, and with that, the meeting's adjourned.